For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. My special guests today are Dr. Michelle Kennedy from the University of Newcastle and Dr. Raglan Maddox from ANU. They are co-authors, co-designers and co-owners of work published in an MJA supplement called Indigenous-Led Evidence to Inform Smoking Cessation Care for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Women. It's a four-chapter supplement about the Which Way study that Michelle led, which was designed to find out what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women wanted in terms of support for becoming smoke-free. The supplement and the editorial that accompanies it are both free to access at mja.com.au. The full links are available in the show notes for this podcast. Welcome to Michelle and Raglan.
I'm Michelle Kennedy. I'm a Wiradjuri woman, and I'm connecting from the lands of the Pamalang clan of the Awabakal Nation.
Hi, I'm Raglan Maddox. I come from the Bagamani and Modawa clans in Papua New Guinea and calling in today from Ngunnawal in the Ngambri country.
We could just acknowledge the traditional owners of our lands and pay respects to our elders past, present and those emerging, and their continued connections and ownership of these unceded lands that we all connect from. I also would like to acknowledge the key partners on this supplement, which we're about to discuss. And I feel very privileged to be able to speak on behalf of our community partners. And I just want to acknowledge Tamworth Aboriginal Medical Service, yep. Nunyara Aboriginal Health Unit, Yerin Aboriginal Health Service and Waminda South Coast Women's Health and Welfare Aboriginal Corporation, who are all co-owners of this work and leaders on the work that we're about to discuss.
Thank you to them and to you for being here today, both of you. Tell us a little bit about the history of tobacco smoking in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander life.
So I guess the history of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tobacco smoking is relatively recent in the scheme of things. Obviously, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the oldest living cultures around the world, and that's something that that as an Indigenous man from PNG, from Papua New Guinea, is I have the incredible privilege of growing up on Ngunnawal in the Ngambri country. And it's a complicated history, and colonisation and the impacts, the ongoing impacts of coloniality impact Indigenous ways of knowing, being and doing in a whole range of ways, and that continues today. In relation to tobacco use, the smoking of tobacco and the embedding of tobacco across Australia and the 250 different languages and 500 dialects, which reflect the diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, has been embedded through colonisation. So up until the late 1960s, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were paid in rations of tobacco in lieu of wages and things like that. So it's complicated. It's complicated in that it was introduced and embedded through that process. In parts of Northern Australia, it was introduced through the Macassans and trading routes, but it's something that is fairly recent in the scheme of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples.
Thanks, Raglan. What has been the effect of those entrenched habits and behaviours? What has been the effect on health outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples?
The impact is ongoing. So we have, and there's a whole range of reasons why tobacco use has been entrenched. One of the other things I will mention, and I think this context is incredibly important, and sometimes we skim over the context, but Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been excluded from the cash economy and paid in rations of tobacco. They've been excluded from the education system, overrepresented in the justice system. And all these things are actually determinants for tobacco use. So we talk about the social determinants of health and well-being. Those experiences of racism, discrimination, exclusion mean that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and Indigenous people around the world as well are more likely to experience those risk factors that put them at risk of commercial tobacco use. In addition, we know that big tobacco companies target Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We've seen in recent years letters going out to Aboriginal medical services encouraging the use of e-cigarettes, things like that. So we see this ongoing impact that results in a smoking prevalence, a daily smoking prevalence of 40% among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across the country. But that prevalence ranges and there is great diversity across the country, even though we have seen significant declines over the last 15 years. In terms of health outcomes, we know that when we look at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander specific data, that tobacco is accountable for 37% of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander deaths and 50% of all deaths among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people aged 45 and over. In terms of here we are during NAIDOC Week celebrating Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander excellence, Indigenous excellence, languages, cultures, resilience. If we can remove this completely preventable burden of death and disease, those languages, that oldest living cultures in the world, will continue to thrive for many, many generations to come. And I think part of the work that Which Way and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander governance has led and celebrated, there's some really exciting opportunities there for us to get around and as public health and health professionals to support communities and future generations to thrive.
Give me some numbers, if you can, about smoking in pregnancy in the community. What are the numbers like versus non-Indigenous, for example, populations?
Smoking and pregnancy numbers are around 44% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are smoking in pregnancy compared to about 11% in the general population. That's really what inspired me as an Aboriginal woman to be involved in this research because I've entered this research world looking at these stats which talk about this high prevalence of smoking during pregnancy. And as an Aboriginal woman, knowing there's so much more behind those numbers. So while people love to, you know, use the statistics and report it, it gives a very deficit approach. And when we look at the statistics and people ask about the statistics, they want to look at Aboriginal women and compare them to non-Aboriginal women. But as Raglan's offered as that introduction, our experiences to get to the point of counting our prevalence rates are so different. So it doesn't really help us inform what we need to do, what health providers need to do to actually support and empower Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women to be smoke-free.
Would it be fair to say that Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander women want to quit smoking?
Absolutely.
But haven't had the access to the healthcare and the support programs that would help them to do that?
Not to jump to the end, but some of the findings that is in our supplement is that 90% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in our study had made a quit attempt. We know that during pregnancy, but also beyond pregnancy, when we're looking at addressing smoking in pregnancy, my community partners and myself have said we actually need to not look at just some small period in a woman's life, look at how we can support Aboriginal women as a whole to be smoke-free and empower them to be smoke-free. But we already knew this. Sandra Eade's study in 2011 said that 70% of Aboriginal women who were advised by their doctor that they should quit made a quit attempt. Motivation has always been high. Motivation in the Aboriginal population is high. Aboriginal people are more likely to make a quit attempt than non-Aboriginal people. We're just less likely to succeed. So that's a really great starting point to look at the motivation. Motivation's there. We don't need to build motivation or incentive for people to quit. We need to enhance the types of support that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are offered so they can succeed in their quit attempts.
So let's talk about the Which Way study. Can you tell us a little bit about your methods and your design and what it was you were actually trying to get to?
The Which Way study, Which Way is a term that Aboriginal people use to mean what, where, how. So often Aboriginal people meet each other and say, hey, which way? So the study is all about that. What, where, how can we, what can we do better for tobacco control? And the Which Way study is all about putting the control and privileging the voices and experiences of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the decision-making about what types of support services or policy reforms are needed to be smoke-free. The Which Way study was developed in partnership with Aboriginal communities. And it's important to say that I never called an Aboriginal community and asked them to partner in this project. I spent a lot of time at the end of my PhD doing some knowledge translation. So any opportunities I had to talk to communities about what I was researching and what I was finding, and then communities came to me and said, we want to partner in this. We want to be part of this. We feel like we can drive the solutions and the things that our people need. So the project started from the grassroots, really. I established a fellowship application for NHMRC that was very vague in building an Indigenous-led evidence base for smoking cessation care in pregnancy that was grounded in Indigenous knowledges and wisdom and communities as the knowledge holders.
Were you testing different interventions, or were you testing the interventions the community wanted?
So it's interesting to talk about interventions, because in my PhD, I looked at all the interventions that have been done in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women smoking in pregnancy. And we actually don't have two key things. We don't actually have evidence of what works, in inverted commas, for those who can't see me, to empower people to be smoke-free. Yep. What we have when we talk about interventions or the work that's been done in evidence-based care, it's been drawn from the general population mm-hmm. and tested with Aboriginal people. Which way is about hitting a pause on that and saying, what do Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women want to be smoke-free? What would empower them to be smoke-free? And how do we then build the evidence base to then do an intervention to measure effectiveness? So we know there's been a whole range of interventions done using NRT, health provider protocols, training for health providers. And we just wanted to take a step back and say, what is of interest to you, and what would you like to see that could empower you to be smoke-free?
And what did you find out?
What we found out, so much. The biggest thing we found was, here's the kicker, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women are diverse.
Yes.
As are what they want to empower them to be smoke-free. And so everyone wants to know, you know, what's the thing we need to do? And there's never going to be one approach that fits everyone, and one approach that is culturally appropriate approach to be smoke-free. Women told us that they're really interested in group-based supports that incorporate culture. We know from evidence that's coming out of studies like the My Kawai study that culture is integral to our health and well-being. And when we talk about colonization and that's impact on us, that removed our culture, made it illegal in some places to practice our culture. When we're decolonizing, we should also be revitalizing and reclaiming our right to culture, which is not sitting aside health, which is integral to our health and being. Women are also, we had a third of the women that were interested in online or over the phone support. So we can see that while Aboriginal women do want support face-to-face, and there is a lot of opportunities for us to enhance services that are face-to-face for women and bringing people together and having cultural practice, that's not to say online or digital technologies aren't relevant here. They're all relevant.
I might jump in here. I feel like if we're having a conversation, I think Michelle's raised a really good point. And
yeah.
I think the key finding is actually it's a sovereign and self-determined agency type conversation. So I think if there is one message that I've learned, and every day I have the privilege of going into community and hearing from Indigenous women across the country about what they want, it is to have that voice to make their own decisions about being smoke-free. But the irony or the fascinating thing about it is it sort of almost comes back to which way, like how, what, where, why. And it's asking that person. So the person expects when they go into the doctor, they expect from our doctors, from our systems, that they'll be asked, do you smoke? Yes, no. Would you like support to quit? And then it puts the emphasis on the system to be asking, what options do we have available? We have, for the most part, a healthcare system that has an evidence base that we can lean on. We know there are a whole range of multifaceted supports to get around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, families, households, to support them to be smoke-free. And it's about putting them in the driver's seat, saying, what support would you like? How can we support?
I'm chatting today with Michelle Kennedy and Raglan Maddox from the Which Way study, published as a supplement by the MJA. Full links to both the supplement and the accompanying editorial are available in the show notes to this podcast. They are both free to access. If you're enjoying this episode, you can find our full back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts. To subscribe to future episodes, go to your favourite podcast platform. We heartily recommend Spotify and Apple Music. Search for the Medical Journal of Australia and push the subscribe button. It's free. Back to our chat with Michelle and Raglan. Should whitefellas be involved at all?
They have to be involved, right? It should be everybody's business to support Aboriginal people to be smoke-free. And if we put health burdens like this on the onus of Aboriginal people to address colonisation and what it's done to ingrain tobacco in our... it's never going to work. Other evidence has already shown us that health providers, particularly non-Indigenous health providers, lack confidence to ask Aboriginal women, particularly women in pregnancy, about quitting. It's down low on the priorities, every excuse under the sun.
Yeah.
People assume it's someone else's business. It's everyone's business. And it should be. We have closing the gap targets. People are talking about our low birth weight babies. We have national preventative health strategy with tobacco reduction targets. We can only do that if everyone works together. What we don't want to see is particularly non-Indigenous health professionals making Aboriginal people, particularly women in pregnancy, feel shame for their smoke. It should never come from a fear-mongering approach. We shouldn't be addressing it with deficit or fear messaging. It really needs to come from empowering messaging and support. Support women should be told every single time that the best thing for you and your baby is to be smoke-free, and here are the things we can do to support you to do that.
We've probably answered this question, but, and I'm sure you have answered this question, but I'm going to put it out there as well. The fact that it's an Indigenous-led study has made all the difference, hasn't it, in terms of empowering the community?
Having Indigenous-led studies changes everything. It changes everything about the research, from the engagement to Aboriginal communities, but the types of questions that we ask, the way Aboriginal people engage with the research, the iterative processes we take to understand what it is we're finding. So this study was conducted in between July and October 2020, and it has taken until now, not because we've had a break, not because we can blame COVID, but because since October 2020, we have been continually analysing, interpreting, understanding what it is we were finding in partnership with our community partners, and undertaking a whole range of knowledge translation activities to check what it is we're finding and its relevance with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities across the country.
Let's not forget, you did this study in the middle of COVID. How did that impact the way you went about doing it?
Well, the first study we were meant to do was yarning circles. I'm yet to be able to do my yarning circles. We've had COVID and then new waves and influenza. Everything's ruined our yarning circles. But we had already spent 9 months building really solid relationships with our community partners. So when we went into lockdown, we did have to pivot what we were doing, but we already had a really strong foundation to build on. So this study definitely couldn't have been imagined at the start of a lockdown as such. So when we went into lockdown and we had to stop our plans for yarning circles, the community partners had already gained so much momentum and were so empowered to do this research that they said, well, we just got to flip it and do a survey instead. And so we were able to build leverage off those really solid relationships to utilize things like Zoom and co-develop that survey tool in partnership with the communities to make sure it was meaningful. The other thing that happened was, I mean, so many people were then pushed to different ways to recruit. And when we were first designing, how do we recruit to a study like this? How do we do an online survey with Aboriginal people? There wasn't a lot done. There's a lot more being published now and to date, but at that time, there wasn't really a lot done. So we were flying blind. We didn't know whether this would work, whether Aboriginal people would be involved. We never set a time of 3 months. We sort of stopped the study at 3 months because we thought we have 428 women, that's amazing. And we wanted to make sure that we kept that time-sensitive nature within our data collection.
I'm intrigued by the yarning circles part of this. Is that part of what women were saying about wanting to be involved in some kind of group support?
Yarning circles were before we even knew that group support was the choice.
A choice. Yeah. I was just going to say, the other thing is that it changes over the life course as well, hey? So while we looked at, you know, a cross-section of the population, different ages, different experiences mean that at certain times, different options will resonate with women. And so when I was mentioning before, like, let's ask the women what they want when they come into the GP or wherever, that also allows them to be like, today on this beautiful sunny Thursday on Ngunnawal country, I'd like to have this option.
Yes.
But maybe tomorrow it'll be a different option. So it's about meeting those people where they're at. It's community accountability, which I think that community and social accountability is what Michelle was also speaking about, that there is a thirst from communities about what they want and how they want to see it delivered in the services.
Does it feel like things are getting better?
I definitely hope so. I believe so. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are inherent researchers. I get to speak to Aboriginal researchers, whether they have a PhD or not, almost every single day. And a lot of what I do, how I do my research, comes from my family and my community and the way they raised me to do things the right way and work within our ontology, epistemology and axology, our ways of knowing, being and doing. What we need to see is Indigenous-led evidence informing our policy and practice reforms. We know that this is being advocated for with, you know, closing the gap, but we need to be taken seriously. I did a PhD the same way a non-Indigenous person did. I did the Western credentials. And so it's those lived experience credentials that really change the way that the research is done when I do research. And it is that, as Raglan was talking to, that community accountability and reciprocity. That means that the research we do isn't just, as much as the MJA supplement is very exciting, having an Indigenous-led, community-owned MJA supplement is an absolute career highlight for me.
Fantastic.
It doesn't stop at a publication for us.
No.
I have ongoing accountability to the communities to make sure that real change comes from this work. That's really what Indigenous-led evidence does. It takes it above and beyond any pretty publication and ensures that even on a small community-based level, you know, my Awabakal community know exactly what's coming out and what to do. And we have ongoing conversations with health services when they'll say, what should we do? How could we do things differently? We make change happen all the time.
The non-Indigenous policymakers and health professionals, how can we now help to get those changes made?
It's a good question, I think. And we started this conversation talking about coloniality and those ongoing impacts of colonization, which disrupted social structures, culture, positions of power, and have eroded those mechanisms, including obviously the resources and things like land, which are integral to health and well-being. So when we think about that, if we can think about balancing that power relationship, and as we said, the overwhelming theme for me that came through this work is around sovereignty and self-determination. If we can have a direct voice coming through that informs programs and policies. So when I think about the AMA or the MJA, and great to hear some initial first steps around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander subgroup, but what we really need is an editor. We need Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leadership from the top. We need to have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the driving seat, nothing about us without us, acknowledging I'm not Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. But that motto, that is not just a metaphor, that's a lived reality. And Michelle spoke about, you know, she's got the academic, Euro-Western academic credentials. She has a lived experience. She's a mother of four kids or sometimes eight kids. So that sort of experience is embedded and embodied within who she is. And she brings that to the research and then the work that she does, the outputs that come with that. So if it's talking about programs and policies, if we're looking at from the top down, we've seen the successes through co-design processes in response to COVID. We've seen strong Indigenous leadership and the successes that brings. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why we shouldn't be embedding that sort of success in everyday practice, including at the AMA and the MJA. And we should have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples feeling safe and secure and being able to excel in those spaces.
Michelle, what would you do if you were queen of the world tomorrow and you had all the power in the world? What would you do right now to make things better?
I would fund Aboriginal community-controlled health services more appropriately. They are absolutely critical to improving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and wellbeing. 70% of the women in our study used an Aboriginal health service. They are incredibly underfunded.
Yes.
And always go above and beyond. And I know that as an Aboriginal woman who uses my local health service, I look at how our health is improving and the successes that we have. I look at the successes in tobacco control and I attribute a lot of that to the leadership of Aboriginal community controlled health services. And I just would love to imagine what our health could look like if they were resourced appropriately. Aboriginal women in our study told us they want support from their Aboriginal health service and from the Aboriginal health workers to be smoke-free. But the onus isn't just on them. It's everyone's business. But I would give them much more resources.
Are you more hopeful now than you were, say, before the election?
Absolutely. Look, I'm excited about the Closing the Gap report that was produced this year. It makes me hopeful now I go about my work as I am a sovereign researcher. I'm a sovereign Wiradjuri researcher. We're going to do this no matter what. The outcomes of our MJA supplement are already progressing into the next phases of work. Mm-hmm. And the community partners and I, we're not going to rely on people wanting, we're doing this work regardless. Because this is about our women and it's about our babies and it's about our future. So being sovereign and continuing to feel strength within that is the way I'm moving forward.
I think on top of that, Michelle, I guess one of the interesting things when we talked about the growth of or the perceived growth of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander led, governed, owned research and evaluation and being more accessible, I guess, in the Euro-Western sense. So it's how do we create space for that? And Michelle, you just spoke about the leadership from the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisations. I was just thinking about as you were saying that, I guess we've seen a 9.8% reduction in daily smoking prevalence among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people since 2004-05. Which is a massive absolute decline. So 50,000 fewer daily smokers today than if prevalence had stayed the same. And so I guess I really wanted to acknowledge and celebrate as well the successes of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, in spite of all these challenges that we've talked about, that Aboriginal people are quitting smoking, that they're making change. And we saw that in the Which Way study, hey? Like we hear about some of the deficit-based reporting and closing the gap, but we don't acknowledge the amount of quit attempts that are made. We don't acknowledge necessarily that actually Aboriginal women during pregnancy are reducing and making quit attempts in spite of maybe not being asked to quit. Maybe some of the research highlights that the doctors aren't suggesting to quit, they're just suggesting to reduce. Yeah. And what happens when doctors only suggest to reduce is that the women are reducing but not making a quit attempt. So we know, and the evidence shows, if you're asked to quit, you'll make a quit attempt. So that's the expectation, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people expect excellence. And I think we have you sort of spoke about non-Indigenous people or settlers before, and I'm growing up off country, right? Like I guess in what's now known as Australia, and PNG has been independent since 75. There's a settler myself, and acknowledging that relational accountability, I have an obligation to support Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, Indigenous siblings around the world, to be the best people that they want to be. And so I guess that's where that sovereignty decision comes in. How can we support those people? Because we also know that 60% of people are making are quitting successfully without support. Yeah. So imagine the success if we get around them and support people.
The community partners are also authors on all of these publications. So everything that's being published has already gone through with community. The community are authors on it and have contributed to it and kept me accountable to make sure what I've said is actually right and true and on point.
So thank you both. I really appreciate it.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.